I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the stuff that keeps you up at night. We're going to talk about sleep disorders. We're going to talk about what causes them, what they do to your life, and what you can do about them. My guests will include two doctors, neurologist Dr. Ted Nukas, and pain treatment specialist Dr. Dimitri Arbuck. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about sleep disorders. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are a couple of experts in the field, Dr. Ted Nukas, who's a neurologist. Dr. Nukas, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us here.
It's good to have you here. And Dr. Dimitri Arbuck, who is a pain treatment specialist. Dr. Arbuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's good to have both of you here. Well, let's start first by talking about, you know, what a sleep disorder is. It's one of those terms that kind of gets bandied around. It's not a single night when you can't sleep because you had stress at the office, I presume. It's something that's more ongoing. Can I start with you, Dr. Nukas?
Well, there are probably five or six different major categories of sleep disorders. And you just brought up in insomnia. Mm-hmm. Insomnias are a very important class of sleep disorders where people have trouble obtaining or maintaining sleep. You also have disorders of breathing, such as sleep apnea, disorders of wakefulness, such as narcolepsy, disorders of circadian rhythm, such as jet lag, or people that, you know, you have your teenager that won't go to sleep before 1 o'clock, or your 80-year-old that can't stay awake after 6 o'clock. These are circadian rhythm disorders. Movement disorders, such as periodic limb movements, or limb movements at night. And parasomnias, unusual disorders where people can wake up and sleepwalk, sleep talk, sleep eat. And also, sleep disorders are associated with other medical illnesses, whether they be heart, cardiac disease, lung disease, cancers, menopause, and psychiatric illness and pain disorder.
Dr. Arbuck, how common are sleep disorders? I mean, how either in terms of a percentage of the population or a number of people who are affected by them?
Well, majority of people at a certain point in their time may and frequently do have sleep problems. In medicine in general, distinction between a problem and a disorder is the level of functional impairment. Mm-hmm. So frequently people mix those things. And not to sleep one night, two nights, may be just fine, depending on circumstances. But when it becomes such a problem that people cannot function and it impairs their daytime activity, productive activity, this is when it is so stressful that it needs to be attended. I am a psychiatrist and a pain management specialist, and sleep disorders is part of my life, but I'm not a sleep specialist per se, so Dr. Nukas knows percentages better.
Yeah, Dr. Nukas, well, I think that's your cue.
Sure. Well, that's the one fascinating thing about sleep disorders is that they really are involved with all branches of medicine, psychiatry, pulmonology, cardiac, orthopedics, pain management, all of these different subspecialties have a component of a sleep disorder in the care of those patients. And what Dr. Arbuck said is exactly right. There is a, people have studied, for example, insomnias for a long period of time and divided insomnias into multiple different types of insomnias. Some people have insomnia because of anxiety. Some people have insomnia because of depression or other psychiatric illness. Some people have primary insomnia. They just have a gene that where they just can't get to sleep, and they've had this their entire lives. The important thing is that it's not just one night. Most of the insomnias require at least 6 months of continuous problem that interferes with functioning.
Before
you can really make that diagnosis
make it
of an insomnia.
Consider it a disorder of
That's
some
right.
kind. Let's take a step here. In terms of the numbers of people, it sounds like at some point or another, quite a few of us at least have, and I'm gathering from Dr. Arbuck, we need to make a distinction here between what might be considered a sleep problem, which would be a temporary thing, and a disorder, which is longer and actually has a more profound impact on a person's life. In terms of what it does to people's lives, how does it affect them? I'll stay with you on that one, Dr. Nukas.
Well, if you look at two very common classes of sleep disorders, first sleep disorder breathing, sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Untreated sleep apnea, especially over long periods of time, has a horrible effect on people's cardiovascular health. It's a large increase of heart disease, lung disease, such as pulmonary hypertension, too much pressure in the lungs, stroke, infections, and even cancer rates increase in people that have obstructive sleep apnea. If you would take 100 people with obstructive sleep apnea, severe apnea, and follow them over a 15-year period, only 60 would be surviving if they're untreated. Whereas if you treat the sleep apnea, 90 would be surviving over any 15-year period. So you can see that the effects of sleep apnea are horrible on people's overall mortality, and especially their cardiac mortality.
What is the cause of something like that? I mean, is that a cause or is it a symptom?
Well,
a larger problem.
Well,
could it be both?
Yeah, there's multiple things that cause obstructive sleep apnea. Number one on the list is overweight. Mm-hmm. If you're overweight, it is a huge risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea. Your neck diameter, oropharyngeal anatomy, what the anatomy looks like behind your tongue. Mm-hmm. Does somebody have a low palate? Does somebody have a narrow area behind the tongue? Those are huge risk factors for obstructive sleep apnea. The interesting thing is, genetics are important and ethnicity is important. In Americans of European ancestry, weight is really important in your risk for obstructive sleep apnea. But in Americans of other origins, Asian origin or African Americans, weight, yes, is important, but it is not as important. Many people that are not overweight have sleep apnea, especially in those different ethnicities or origins.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I was curious if you would maybe talk about sleep paralysis, something that I have experienced off and on for about a year of my life. I experienced it really regularly several times a night. I had some associated hallucinations and just some other really bizarre symptoms and never could really get a good answer from doctors about why it was happening. And as I researched it, it seemed that the bizarre stories often had some strange commonalities between them, and was just really curious if you could give me any insight into that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Andy. We'll try to get an answer for you. Dr. Nukas?
Andy, that's a great question. Sleep paralysis is one very common symptom of people that have narcolepsy. Now, what sleep paralysis is, as you know, is you are awake, you're asleep, and you're awake, but you can't move. And it's one of the symptoms of of not of a change or an inability of the switch from sleep to wake to really work properly. You're not really completely awake, and when you're in REM sleep, you have a mechanism that prevents all of the muscles from moving except your diaphragm. That mechanism is not working properly when you have sleep paralysis. Now, there are some people that will have sleep paralysis and not have narcolepsy. But, of course, narcolepsy is involved with extreme excessive daytime sleepiness, cataplexy or a loss of tone during an emotional experience, and a number of other symptoms.
Dr. Auerbach, can we talk about, in terms of one's emotional or psychological well-being, what does having your sleep disturbed or having a sleep disorder do to a person?
Emotions do certainly play a role in sleep. As all of us know, when we're anxious, a lot's on your mind, you have problem with your boss, problem with your child, then racing thoughts and worries keep you awake. It is not a disorder per se. It's a normal mechanism by which brain basically takes more time to think about the situation, thinking about how to solve the problem. This is what you are doing. You worry about it, but you think about solutions. It's not bad per se, unless it goes on for months and months and disturbs your sleep more and more.
And if it does that, though, what is the effect on a person's psychological or emotional well-being?
If people don't sleep, they die. That's very simple how it is. If you don't sleep at all for more than 3 nights, then your life is in danger. And insomnia, which is associated with lethal outcome when people are kept awake. This is actually a torture. It's one of the sleep deprivation techniques. But it is so unusual that it may be opposite. For instance, depression, which is associated with insomnia so tightly, there's so-called Russian method of treating of depression, which is more effective treatment of depression than anything else on planet Earth. Depression completely goes away with sleep deprivation. And if you keep a person awake for a day or two, depression completely goes away. But as soon as you sleep, next morning, you're depressed again. So it's not a treatment which can be practically used. But we know that for many reasons just described, there is a very tight coordination between and correlation between emotions and sleep.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Jimmy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you guys?
Doing well. What's on your mind, Jimmy?
Hey, I'm 34 years old. I've used a CPAP machine for the last, 8 years. I'm pretty fit. I cycle every day. Not overweight. Doctor said I've probably had it my whole life, and he said that it was central sleep apnea, and I don't know what that means, and I was wondering if you could explain that to me.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jimmy. Yes, Dr. Nukas.
Well, you can divide sleep apnea into two major types of diseases. One is obstructive sleep apnea. This is where the airway gets obstructed and air doesn't flow, either by your tongue or by your oropharynx closing. Then you have central sleep apnea. In central sleep apnea, the brain no longer sends the message to your lung to breathe. Now, there's a number of reasons why this can happen. Some people have a congenital sleep apnea. Some people just have difficulty. Some people's brains just don't appreciate the level of carbon dioxide in the blood that they should and have what's called an elevated apneic threshold. Then there's also some medications that will cause central sleep apnea.
What is the most common form of sleep disorder?
Probably insomnia is the most common cause.
And what are the causes for insomnia or the things that produce it most often?
The three most common causes of insomnia are depression and adjustment disorder, anxiety, and people often have what's called psychophysiologic insomnia.
What's that?
And that is when there's a conditioned response of activation to the bed. You go to sleep, and all of a sudden you have racing thoughts. You get angry that you can't sleep, and you just sit there and pout and say, oh, my gosh, why can't I fall asleep today?
So if you're struggling with something like that, what's the best way to deal with it?
Well, really, you need to take two treatment approaches at the same time to treat this type of insomnia. A short course of a medication to allow someone to sleep is important, but also cognitive behavioral therapy is important. Looking at your sleep hygiene, what do you do before you go to bed? Do you have activating periods? Are you in front of bright lights before you go to sleep? Using the bed only for sleep and not for TV or any other purposes.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Ted Nukas and Dr. Dimitri Arbuck. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about sleep disorders, about the things that keep us awake at night, and what the primary sleep disorders are, what some of the causes are. Probably ought to take a step back from this, because the conversation's been so interesting, and callers have gotten interested in it, too, and just say, what are some of the parameters? What is there a range of what is considered a normal or typical or healthy sleep pattern? Could I start with you, Dr. Arbuck, on that?
All your questions are so big. I think each of them requires a couple of hours to answer.
It's well, I know. I get that. But is there at least in terms of what we were taught as kids, you need 8 hours of sleep every night. Every night. Is that true, or does it vary from person to person?
It varies from age group to age group. And in kids, 8 hours is okay. In adults, actually, it's too much. The normal sleep is 6 hours to 7.5 hours. And that's basically what is best for person's performance. Actually, sleeping more than 8 hours associated with increase in people being sick and increase in deaths. So too long of a sleep is not good. And longer than 8 hours, you may do it sometimes when you're lazy, but as a rule, it's not a good idea to sleep long.
And Dr. Nukas, one of the things that I had heard, at least when I was younger, is that you actually need less sleep the older you get. Is that true, or is that?
Yeah, that's right. You really sleep a little less the older you get. Also, your sleep quality and sleep stages change as you get older too. When you're younger, from a child to maybe 20s to early 30s, when you first go to sleep at night, you have a lot of what's called slow wave sleep. This is the restorative part of sleep. This is where you feel rested. As you get older, you no longer have slow wave sleep. You take somebody that's 60 years old or 70 years old, they have no slow wave sleep. They have their REM stage and their early stages 1 and 2. Now, the interesting thing about...
What produces that change over time?
Well, nobody really knows why it changes, but we do know there's some endocrine associations between the different stages of sleep. So slow-wave sleep, especially in men, causes you to release growth hormone. Okay. So as you get older, into your 70s, you probably don't need that growth hormone. Yeah. And we don't have slow-wave sleep when the growth hormone isn't released. In women, growth hormone is released really throughout the day, although there is a spike in growth hormone when slow-wave sleep occurs in females at night. It's not as robust as it is in men. So I've always wondered, if you look at aging, that if you were to give a medication that were to restore slow-wave sleep in an older patient, maybe you could improve performance. You would improve their growth hormone levels, improve performance, improve their muscular tone and strength, prevent hip fractures, and maybe be some type of an anti-aging tool. Well, nobody's really doing that, but that's just a thought that I've had over the past few years.
Dr. Arbuck.
Well, I like a theory which kind of fits my understanding of what sleep is there for. But theory is that all information-based systems, brain needs to somehow accommodate the information which it receives and write it down permanently on proteins in our brain. And for that theory goes that you need to have time to prepackage information, and they need time to write it down. So prepackaging is a slow wave when things are being put in order, and then quick writing down, recording basically the information and connecting it with the knowledge you already have written down. So this is a very active process. And this is why more you learn in childhood, we learn a lot. Probably majority of what we know, we learn by age 3. And then you need to learn less and less percentage-wise. So less and less need in REM sleep.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jason, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Just curious, been diagnosed with the sleep apnea and depression, and just curious if those have any correlation with each other.
All right, we'll try to get an answer for you. Thank you very much for the call, Jason. Well, are there sleep disorders that do have connections or correlations?
Yeah, I think a very common psychiatric illness in patients that have obstructive sleep apnea is depression.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in many women, depression is actually a chief complaint of people that have a sleep disorder and have obstructive sleep apnea.
Are there other sleep disorders that have connections to each other? I mean, do these things tend to come in sets, or are there some that are standalones?
Well, what's really interesting in medicine, you're taught in medical school of what's called Osler's rule, which there is a famous Canadian physician named Osler who said, you know, people usually have one thing wrong with them producing all these different symptoms. In sleep medicine, it's actually the opposite. Usually people have more than one medical condition, and they have more than one more than one sleep disorder in one person, causing a myriad of different types of symptoms. So, yes, there's interconnections between psychiatric illness and between cardiac disease and between all the different sleep disorders. For example, people that have narcolepsy have a higher incidence of sleep apnea. You know, Dr. Arbuck is a pain specialist, and he sees people with horrible pain, terrible pain syndromes all day long. And many of those people have sleep disorders. They have sleep apnea, they have central sleep apnea, they have insomnias, and they have, you know, terrible conditions that needed to be looked at as a separate focus of treatment in addition to their pain.
How do you deal? You know, obviously, if someone is in tremendous pain, that would inhibit sleep, I would think, Dr. Arbuck. How do you deal with that situation?
Pain does interfere with sleep, but interestingly enough, the biggest factor which interferes with sleep is environmental temperature. So if it's a hot environment, it's much more disturbing to sleep than being in pain. But we're good in controlling pain in general, and either acute or chronic. The problem frequently is not the pain, but medications people take for pain, especially combinations. And nowadays, you know, there is an epidemic of abuse of opiates, mm-hmm. and the prescription of benzodiazepines very common. So people who combine medications like Vicodin, Norco, hydrocodone, and Xanax and Clonopin, they do have such an impairment of breathing and sleep that they frequently, unfortunately, end up not waking up in the morning. And people get very angry when they hear that they should not combine those medications because it's so dangerous. But people like their medications sometimes more than their life, so we need to fight sometimes against that.
Are there, while we're on this, are there behavioral or lifestyle choices that can inhibit sleep too? I mean, smoking, drinking, we've talked obviously about having carrying too much weight can inhibit mm-hmm. sleep. Are there other things that are likely to affect your sleep patterns?
Well, John, that's a great point. You brought up the whole concept of what constitutes good sleep hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know what constitutes good hand hygiene is washing your hands. Okay, mm-hmm. but for sleep, not having activating behaviors at night, not drinking too much alcohol too close to bedtime, smoking cigarettes, caffeine too late in the evening, bright lights. If you're around bright lights within an hour or two of going to sleep, that can inhibit your production of melatonin and keep you awake. So all of those things are important for good sleep hygiene in order to obtain and maintain a healthy night's sleep.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Well, to be honest with you, in that last conversation you just had, you answered one of my questions. My next question would have been, at night, I like to take melatonin to help fall asleep at night just because my job is stressful and my life is stressful. But I was also curious, sometimes the melatonin doesn't necessarily help. Are there any other methods that you gentlemen like to help fall asleep at night?
I'll start with Dr. Arbuck on that one. Thank you very much for the call, Patrick.
Well, Patrick, the best is for you to read my book. The name is Mastermind, and you can find it on Amazon or mastermindmethod.com. And this is a book I wrote to give people an opportunity to regulate their function, mood, pain, including sleep. So it gives specific techniques, which you can use, psychological techniques, to help you with sleep. So Mastermind on Amazon can help with that. But general things which are well-known, other than not to expose yourself to bright light, you should not eat when you go to bed at least a couple of hours with no food. Caffeine, people frequently don't think about eating chocolate candies in the evening. It may be enough to keep you awake. You also need to not to exercise heavily before you go to sleep. You need to not drink too much water because that may wake you up through the night for you to go to the bathroom. And there are multiple techniques which are based on relaxation, and this is a cornerstone of your self-regulation for sleep. You need to be relaxed. Muscle spasms are not good, and anxiety are not good. So anything which relaxes you and helps anxiety is good. And I can also comment on melatonin point. Melatonin is a hormone which is actually hormone of skin color in humans and in animals. And it is produced in part in pituitary gland, which used to be very close to the skin in animals. And bright light would shine through the skin into the gland, and gland would stop producing melatonin, and an animal would turn light and start moving faster. And then as night would fall, melatonin production would increase because light would not stimulate the gland too much, and animal would get slower and sluggish and fall asleep because it's safer to do in the nighttime. In humans, this gland migrated over time from under the skin and between the eyes pretty deep in the brain, but connection remains. This is why light affects sleep very much. This is why melatonin affects sleep very much. But nothing works in everybody, melatonin including.
Are there any, like if you are, let's assume this hasn't gotten to the level of a sleep disorder, but someone's having trouble sleeping, that any of the old home remedies that we talked about, having a glass or a cup of warm milk or something like that, does that have some sort of natural sedative effect, Doctor?
Yeah, those can be effective. What really works well is a sleepy time tea. Tea that has valerian in it, and valerian is a mild sedative. I think using on an occasional basis over-the-counter sleep aids or even prescription sleep aids on an occasional basis is a legitimate thing to do. You know, all doctors have their bias, and my bias is that I don't like to have patients for long periods of time on on the Ambiens and Sonatas and those types of sleep medicines. I think they're fine medicines for a short period of time, but I don't like patients on them for long periods of time. For people that have chronic insomnias, there are other medications we can use that are maybe a little less habit-forming.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. Kip, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm in my mid-30s. I was diagnosed about 10 years ago with narcolepsy or hypersomnia, and I just wanted to share that it's pretty discouraging because I've seen a lot of different specialists, and it just feels like there's not necessarily a cure. There just seems to be a Band-Aid, and it's frustrating to be so lethargic most days and just feel so drained and lack of energy. So if you could address that, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Kip. Well, first, why don't we talk about the Dr. Nukas, why don't we start with you talking about whether there is a cure or whether there's a Band-Aid, and then Dr. Auerbach, if we could talk a little bit about how you cope with having to deal with a sleep disorder that will not disappear quickly.
Yeah. You know, I'm really sorry, but boy, for narcolepsy, like many other conditions, there is really no good disease-modifying treatment. We're able to accomplish a lot of things in medicine, but there are rare things that we have cures for. We can't cure diabetes. We can't cure hypertension. So we can certainly lower your blood sugar with medications and lower your blood pressure with medications, but there's no cure. The second you stop taking your insulin, your blood sugar will go back up again. The same thing is true for narcolepsy. There are a number of different medications that work fairly well in many people for narcolepsy. But you're right. The caller's right. It's a Band-Aid. We can give medications such as stimulants, Ritalin or Dexedrine, Adderall. We can give medications that promote wakefulness, such as Modafinil or Provigil or Nuvigil. And then there's a medication that can be given at night called Xyrem that helps, which is a fascinating medication that helps consolidate sleep in the evening and also is a little bit of a stimulant when you wake up in the morning.
Dr. Auerbach, the second part of that, really, I mean, he was talking about, it's just almost depressing to have to sort of wrap his head around the fact that he's going to be lethargic and all of that and not feel as he should. What are some strategies or ways that a person can cope with a persistent sleep disorder?
Well, narcolepsy specifically, psychological techniques are not that effective, unfortunately, because it's such a biological condition that though psychology does play a role in it, but medications is the mainstream of treatment, stimulants or Xyrem-modifying medication, as Dr. Nukas just mentioned. With other sleep disorders, though, the way of general hygiene works. If you eat well, if you exercise, if you take supplements appropriately, not too much, if you use appropriate food, food stuff, then you, in general, function better and sleep is better too. But certain conditions, as we talked about, are associated with emotions more and certain with biology more. And though, of course, emotions and biology are connected, but more medical conditions like narcolepsy really require medication treatment, sometimes combination of medications, frequently combination, and sometimes pretty high doses. There is an area in the brain which regulates sleep-wake cycle. It's run on a very rare chemical, neurochemical. The name is orexin or hypocretin, another name of it. And there are just a few hundred cells which produce this this neurochemical, but it is a cornerstone of our good sleep. So if you don't have that, you're in trouble. And we cannot make brain to produce it too well. We make certain medications which keep it up and therefore helping sleep, but we cannot make brain permanently produce this substance.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. My guests are Dr. Ted Nukas and Dr. Dmitry Auerbach. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about sleep disorders. My guests are Dr. Ted Nukas, who is a neurologist, and Dr. Dimitri Arbuck, who is a pain treatment specialist. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email, and you can do so by sending it to WFYI.org. We've gotten an email from a listener named Kelly who wanted to ask a simple question. Does alcohol cause insomnia? Dr. Ted Nukas.
Well, it doesn't. It does and it does. Okay. When you first drink, alcohol actually will cause you to be more fatigued and more sedated and go into sleep. And actually, early on, when you just start to drink, it'll cause you to go into stage three sleep, the more relaxing stage of sleep early. But as the alcohol wears off, you'll wake up and it causes more restless sleep. Over long periods of time, an individual that's an alcoholic will oftentimes have very restless sleep and very fragmented sleep. And this can persist for up to a year or two, even after you stop drinking. So the chronic use of alcohol can cause a sleep disorder and damage to your sleep that can last far beyond the length of time that you're drinking.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Michelle saying, I have fibromyalgia, I hope I pronounced that right, and or chronic fatigue syndrome. I sleep between 10 and 12 hours per night. If I don't get that much sleep, my body hurts and I have poor quality of life. What is it about these diseases that makes my body require so much sleep?
Well, fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome is a condition when people experience pain in the muscles, in the body. But it isn't not a disease of muscles. It's a disease of central nervous system. It's a disease of how brain, how spinal cord process the pain impulses. And when there is an abnormal process of recognition of those symptoms or those pain signals, then people have generalized pain all over. When the nervous system does not function, it's not just pain, but everything is usually out of order. Immune system, coordination, reaction to medications, mood, sleep, sexual function, appetite, etc., etc. So basically, it's a global dysfunction of central nervous system. So the way of treating fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome is treatment of central nervous system in general. And sleep is a big, big part of fibromyalgia. Actually, there is a theory, some sleep specialists, and you know how specialists are. Everybody believes their specialty explains everything. So some sleep specialists believe that that fibromyalgia is a sleep disorder because about 100% of people with fibromyalgia do have sleep problems.
So you're telling me that medical specialists are actually like human beings in that way.
Even worse.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Chris, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I recently been diagnosed with sleep apnea, and I'm supposed to be fitted for a CPAP machine. That hasn't happened yet. I have a question. I have a couple of symptoms. I'm wondering if they're related to sleep apnea. One is that I get severe night sweat. So it will happen, you know, a couple times a week that I'll wake up and I'll actually have soaked through my T-shirt. I sweated so much at night. The other thing is that a lot of times I have no problem falling asleep at night, no problem whatsoever, but I often will wake up several times, and if I wake up around 2 or 3 in the morning, half the time I just can't get back to sleep, which, you know, it seems counterintuitive. If I'm not sleeping deeply, you think I'd be tired and fatigued, but I'm wondering if that could be because of sleep apnea and if the CPAP machine might help with both those things if there's symptoms of it.
Dr. Nukas, thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Well, the answer to the first question is yes. Sleep apnea can cause night sweats. If the night sweats, however, persist after your sleep disorder breathing has been adequately treated, you probably need to go back to your primary care doctor to look for other causes for night sweats. With the second question is, chances are, I mean, a common complaint I hear is that I wake up in the middle of the night and I can't get back to sleep. because I've had sleep apnea. When you treat the sleep apnea, oftentimes people don't wake up in the middle of the night and they can sleep the whole night through. But there may be another insomnia. If the symptoms persist, there may be another issue involved. There may be another insomnia, restless limb movements, or something else that need to be evaluated.
Yeah, we've got two questions that are on that line and email. One from a listener named Judith who says, once you're diagnosed as having sleep apnea and using CPAP, should retesting be done to see if you still have sleep apnea? If so, when? How long should you wait, I guess?
If there's been more than a 10 to 15% loss of body weight, then you probably need to be retested. Probably about every 3 years, you need to have another CPAP titration because people change over the over 3 years. Some physicians will also, after you've been on the CPAP for a period of time, will try to lower it by a centimeter or two because after you've been on it for a while or a short period of time, edema goes down and your airways are a little bit more pliable, a little more open.
And Dave reached out to us via Facebook and says, I'm going to paraphrase this, for years he suffered from symptoms of restless legs 2 or 3 weeks out of the month. What type of medical professional should he be seeing for something like this?
A neurologist.
A neurologist? So he should come see someone like you.
Sure.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. PJ, welcome to the program. PJ?
Hello.
Hello, PJ. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Hi there. I have a question for your panel. I don't fall asleep very easily at night. It takes me maybe an hour and a half to fall asleep. And when I do, this happens at least 5 nights out of the week, I will wake up. I fall asleep on my back. I wake up in a panic, like I feel like I'm dying. I grab my throat. I feel like I can't breathe. And I yell out to my husband, I need my medicine. I need my medicine. I don't take medicine. It's like this recurring nightmare of where I'm either strangling or dying or something. And it's been going on for years.
Dr. Nugis.
And I don't know what to do about it.
Well, there's about four or five things that could cause that. The first thing we would want to do is to check you for obstructive sleep apnea. Then there are other types of conditions, parasomnias, or there's even a sleep disordered cardiac abnormality that needs to be evaluated as well, called Brugada syndrome. And you're going to need to have an EKG and some other testing for that.
Because I also heard a fear component in that too, something that sounds like it would have a psychological component. Dr. Arbuck.
Well, anxiety may play a role, and panic attacks very frequently happen in the middle of the night, and sometimes people describe it exactly as our listener describes when people wake up with fear of death and feeling that they have a heart attack, something like that. But she certainly needs to be evaluated appropriately, both neurologically and psychiatrically, and with proper interviewing, it will be more clear what's going on.
Lay, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm sorry. My name is Lee. I'm calling from Indianapolis, and thank you for this show. It's really great. I love your show, but this is very, very interesting to me because when I was 19, I had Epstein-Barr virus, and I was in college at the time, and I was just exhausted, and nobody knew why, and I had many tests, and finally they realized that's what it was. So I came home from school, and I stayed in bed for literally 9 months. And ever since then, I have just not felt well. And I'm 50 now.
We'll see if we can get some guidance for you here. Dr. Nugis?
Well, you know, it sounds like you may have something like chronic fatigue syndrome. And I'm not an expert at chronic fatigue syndrome. There is a lot of new changes that have happened. There is a, and Dr. Arbuck can maybe answer some questions for you, but there's been some changes in the way people look at chronic fatigue syndrome, thinking that it's actually inflammation within the brain or the covering of the brain. That's kind of a controversial diagnosis. But
Dr. Arbuck, why don't we see?
Well, immune system is in a center of many different human conditions. We don't know enough about it, don't pay enough attention to that. But Epstein-Barr virus is a virus of mononucleosis. Basically, it's mono. And it is very common in population. If you test general population, probably 70-80% people will be positive for former infection. Not all of us are aware of having mono, but majority of us in one or another time in their life do have that. And like any viral disease, it produces body response, and the immune system kicks in and starts to clear the body from viruses. Unfortunately, with some viruses, cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, some other viruses, some bacteria like Lyme disease, for instance, those microorganisms may associate themselves with the cells in the body, either nerve cells, central nervous system cells, muscle cells, blood cells, and then they fool immune system into thinking that basically, to make it simple, body starts thinking that its own tissues are foreign tissues and attack it. And that is associated with massive problems with immune system fatigue, emotional problems, sleep problems, and this is likely what you have in one way or another.
We are talking about sleep disorders here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Maureen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I just put together, listening to your show, this idea that maybe my poor daughter, who at age 10 developed sleep problems, maybe there's been a chain reaction in her life where it started like within months of her older sister deciding she needed her own bedroom. And then, bam, the younger daughter has sleep problems. A year after that, she gets ulcerative colitis. So I wondered if sleep problems are known to result in autoimmune issues, and if that kind of loss at age 10, you know, my sleeping partner and my, you know, they weren't in the same bed, whether that has caused sleeping problems. And then, you know, if she spent half her life with sleep problems, can she take some steps now to reverse that?
Give each of you a crack at that. We got a lot of callers, so I want to try to get to as many of them
just
as possible.
Just very briefly, yes, I think that sleep disorders can cause autoimmune disorders. Whether insomnias or adjustment sleep disorders can cause ulcerative colitis is unknown to me, but there certainly is a strong association between the immune system and sleep.
And vice versa, it's chicken and egg frequently. Immune system are associated with sleep problems. Sleep problems are associated with higher level of immune problems. We're very complex, and everything is connected.
I'm going to ask, I'm taking time away here, I realize, from the callers, but real quickly, because I think it's going to be a common theme. We've had people call several times and say, you know, who should I see about this particular problem? If you think you have a sleep disorder or a lack of sleep is affecting your life, what's a good first step? Is it talking to your primary care physician and looking for a referral? Or should they go straight start calling a neurologist or a pain treatment specialist?
Yeah. Well, it depends on your what you'd like to do. I mean, some people would feel more comfortable going to their primary care. There are really three major specialties that treat sleep disorders: pulmonologists, neurologists, and psychiatrists. Occasionally, you'll find internal medicine, ear, nose, and throat physicians that will also take care of people with sleep disorders. But it just depends on how you feel and what your primary care doctor is interested in caring for people with sleep disorders are.
Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I have a girlfriend that has a very severe form of narcolepsy, and she is into natural healing and things like that. However, considering that she has a severe form of narcolepsy, she has to take
a lot of drugs. One of them that she is not too excited about is Xyrem. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but I wanted to hear some comments on what they know about Xyrem, especially when it compares to things like sound light treatment.
Dr. Nukas?
Well, you know, Xyrem is a great drug for narcolepsy. Of course, no drug is for everybody, okay? No drug, it works 100% of the time for every person. In my experience, Xyrem has worked fairly well in patients that have cataplexy and have a lot of disruption of their sleep at night. It's very sedating, and for the listening audience, it's a liquid, and it's in a salty brine solution, and you drink it before you go to bed, and then you have to set your alarm and wake up about 3 hours later and drink it again. Even though your sleep's disrupted, most narcoleptics feel that their sleep is much, or their sleep is better than it was before, and they feel much more alert during the day. But as regards to the other types of more holistic therapies for narcolepsy, I haven't been very satisfied with the results in most of my patients that have gone outside the medical model. But then again, everybody's different, and if your girlfriend feels that that is helping her, then that's fantastic.
Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly, we're getting tight on time.
I've heard you talk a bit about the importance of not getting too much bright light right before sleep. My question is, what role does getting bright light earlier in the day play in getting sleep? I know a lot of us spend most of our day indoors. Does getting a lot of sunlight kind of in the morning or around noon help with setting that circadian rhythm?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Megan. Dr. Arbuck.
Light therapy is a fantastic treatment for depression. It's a very good treatment for sleep disorders, too. It's very much underutilized. It's cost-effective. The whole family can benefit from the device, can be found online. But light therapy devices should be at least 10,000 lumens, the intensity, and they do improve mood, they do improve sleep, if used appropriately, increase wakefulness. So they need to be used in the morning, daily, if it's possible, but they are really good and frequently neglected treatments.
Dr. Nukas, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Yeah, when you look at light and melatonin, they're two sides of the same coin. If you look at your circadian rhythm, melatonin will pull you, light will push you. So if you want to sleep later, you have light at night. You want to sleep earlier, you do melatonin at night. If you want to go to bed earlier, you do light in the morning. If you want to go to bed later, you do melatonin in the morning.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank you both for joining us. Dr. Ted Nukas, Dr. Arbuck, thank you very much for being with us. We are going to have you back. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.